Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 2, Induction and Act 1. Which of you will stop the vent of hearing when loud rumor speaks? After the Battle of Shrewsbury, in which the Crown defeats the Percy-led rebels, rumor spreads untruths that the opposite happened. With regard to the induction, it's a stroke of genius to begin a sequel play in this way, with an untrustworthy personification, Rumor, who in the first quarto edition of 1600 is described as, quote-unquote, painted full of tongues. This character opens on a boastful, menacing note towards the audience, asking, quote-unquote, which of you will stop the vent of hearing when loud rumor speaks? Induction, lines 1 through 2. Rumor spreads talk of peace while some party meditates war, and it spreads lies about war when peace might have been secured. Contrariness and chaos appear to be the goals. Of course, rumor isn't an isolated god. It's a product of the human imagination, human fears and desires, and malicious or ill-informed tongues. Almost everyone has seen Norman Rockwell's 1948 print titled The Gossips, where a woman relays something titillating and possibly true to another woman, and 14 people's altered retellings later, it comes back aimed at her. Rumor's power is so irresistible that, even if we start with factual information, we will introduce deviations. So strong is the impulse to inject something of our own, and thereby change the impact of the information. Rumor expresses pride in its ability to make gullible humans, including the theater audience, as it confirms at line 22, do its dirty work. What happens regarding the news about the Battle of Shrewsbury, then, is standard operating procedure for rumor. Even though King Henry, Prince Hal, and their forces are victorious, quite a few people in nearby, quote-unquote, peasant towns, Induction 33, think exactly the opposite happened, namely that Hotspur's rebel forces won the day and Hal and his father were killed in the fighting. Even official couriers seem to be involved in disseminating inaccurate information. We notice something else about Rumor's induction. This character asserts brazenly that Northumberland, Hotspur's father, quote-unquote, lies crafty sick. Induction line 37. In other words, the claim goes, he stayed away from Shrewsbury for political expediency, not because he was really sick. In Act 2, Scene 3, both Northumberland's wife and his daughter-in-law Kate, Hotspur's widow, accuse him of this lethally dishonest dealing. Shakespeare's text may be playing us here, since the historical chronicles he uses to source the play's events generally say that Northumberland was, in fact, too ill to be present at Shrewsbury. So the reason for the introduction of this possibility, by rumor no less, may be that the playwright means to emphasize the fear of betrayal that runs through his history plays, from the major tetralogy to his six other histories. Let one spirit of the firstborn Cain reign in all bosoms. The supposedly sick Northumberland is informed that Hotspur is dead and King Henry's forces are coming after him. The Earl casts aside his illness and prepares for a desperate battle. In Act 1, Scene 1, Lord Bardolph visits Northumberland, saying that he brings, quote-unquote, certain news from Shrewsbury. Act 1, Scene 1, line 12. The trouble is, he's one of the, quote-unquote, thousand tongues, painted on the costume of rumor, so to speak. When Northumberland questions him about the provenance of his news, he says, quote-unquote, I spake with one, my lord, that came from thence. Act 1, Scene 1, line 25. In other words, he's peddling a rumor. But Northumberland's servant, Travers, has heard a rumor that runs to the opposite conclusion. A man racing north on horseback told him, he says, that, quote-unquote, Harry Percy's spur was cold, Act 1, Scene 1, line 42. Enter the messenger Morton, who has surveyed the scene at Shrewsbury. Unfortunately, the news he brings proves devastating. Lord Bardolph is loath to believe Morton's eyewitness account. But Northumberland's worst fears, his prophecy that Hotspur is dead, are confirmed. Morton says of, quote-unquote, Harry Monmouth, Prince Hal, that is, that his, quote-unquote, swift wrath beat down the never-daunted Percy to the earth, from whence with life he nevermore sprung up. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 109 through 111. With Hotspur's death, says Morton, most of his soldiers lost heart, and a rout ensued. Wooster, who is Northumberland's younger brother, Thomas Percy, and Douglas have been captured. Northumberland is strangely invigorated by this terrible report, declaring, quote-unquote, in poison there is physic, and these news, having been well, that would have made me sick, being sick have in some measure made me well. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 137 through 139. He tosses aside the crutch he has been using and seems to embrace violent chaos, crying out, quote-unquote, let order die, and, quote-unquote, let one spirit of the firstborn Cain reign in all bosoms, that each heart being set on bloody courses, the rude scene may end, and darkness be the barrier of the dead. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 155 through 160. Morton and Lord Bardolph both talk Northumberland away from this despair. The first folio edition construes the scene's end more coherently than the quarto version, since Morton's, quote-unquote, "'tis more than time' is followed by, quote-unquote, "'the gentle Archbishop of York is up with well-appointed powers,' he is a man who with a double surety binds his followers. Act 1, Scene 1, on page 76 of the Norton edition, see electronic page 398. The Archbishop can transform the rebellion into a material and spiritual cause. This text makes sense of Northumberland's concluding sentence. Quote unquote, I knew of this before, but this present grief had wiped it from my mind. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 175 through 176. You that are old, consider not the capacities of us that are young. The Lord Chief Justice confronts Falstaff, who is about to join Prince John at York. The magistrate decides not to arrest him for Gadshill, but tries to secure his good conduct. Sir John frets about his advancing age and diminishing purse. Act 1, Scene 2 opens with Falstaff waxing eloquent about the effects of his newborn celebrity since he falsely claimed to have killed Hotspur in battle, and Prince Hal backed him on it. He marvels to his page, who has just made a joke about the doctor's comments concerning Sir John's urine, that, as he says, quote-unquote, I am not only witty in myself, but the cause that wit is in other men. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 8 through 9. Falstaff is busy gussying himself up with satin breeches and cloak to suit his improved reputation, when who should come knocking but the Lord Chief Justice? His Honor has quite a deal of trouble getting through to the talkative, snarky Sir John, but he finally succeeds with, quote-unquote, I sent for you when there were matters against you for your life, to come speak with me. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 121 through 122. The Lord Chief Justice's main concern is not to punish Falstaff for the Gadshill robbery, but rather to bring to the fore the corrupting influence Falstaff has over Prince Hal. Quote unquote, you have misled the youthful prince, he scolds the wayward knight. Act 1, Scene 1, line 132. Incredibly, Falstaff tries to transform this scolding into a dispute between youth and age, saying to the Lord Chief Justice, quote-unquote, You that are old, consider not the capacities of us that are young. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 159 through 160. His Honor needles Sir John with, quote-unquote, "Is not your voice broken, your wind short, your chin double, your wit single, and every part about you blasted with antiquity?" Act 1, Scene 2, lines 166 through 168. Stripped of his youth claim and reminded that he is slated to fight soon along with Prince John against the Archbishop of York and the Earl of Northumberland, Falstaff resorts to trying unsuccessfully to borrow £1,000 from the Lord Chief Justice. It's thought that The Merry Wives of Windsor was composed around the same time as Henry IV Part II, or perhaps a little before it, so this introduction of Sir John's escalating money troubles accords well with the version of him we encounter in Merry Wives, where he is a far less carefree and jovial man than he is in Henry IV Part I especially, but also in much of Part II. Indeed, there is something mean, something predatory, about the Falstaff we encounter in Merry Wives. Shakespeare seems determined to bring out Sir John's dark side more consistently than the two Henry IV plays do, even though the knight's admission of his shocking irresponsibility as a military recruiter and leader is hard to top. At times in Merry Wives, it's hard to see anything in Sir John but a con artist and sexual predator out to ruin the virtue of two very respectable women, Mistress Ford and Mistress Page of Windsor. In Henry IV Part II, alone with his young page, Falstaff makes some intimate confessions, saying, quote-unquote, "I can get no remedy against this consumption of the purse. Borrowing only lingers and lingers it out, but the disease is incurable." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 215 through 218. He bids the page to deliver letters to the great lords of his acquaintance, that is, Prince John and Westmoreland, and tellingly to, quote-unquote, "old Mistress Ursula, whom I have weakly sworn to marry since I perceived the first white hair of my chin." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 220 through 221. Sir John has gout, too, which causes him to limp, but that, he schemes, will only make his pension seem the more justifiable. A touch of predatory intelligence makes itself known. Quote-unquote, "A good wit," he says, quote-unquote, "will make use of anything. I will turn diseases to commodity." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 226 through 227. The old knight is painfully aware that he isn't what he used to be and realizes that he will need to become more and more of a grifter as age gets the better of him. This sounds very much like the Falstaff of Merry Wives. We are time's subjects, and time bids be gone. The Archbishop of York and fellow rebels Mowbray, Hastings, and Lord Bardolph discuss their chances of defeating King Henry. They plan to attract the common people to the rebel cause and exploit Henry's divided military power. In Act 1, Scene 3, during a meeting of some of the chief rebels still alive after Shrewsbury, Lord Bardolph puts the key question to Hastings and the others. It's, quote-unquote, "whether our present 25,000 may hold up head without Northumberland." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 16 through 17. Bardolph also accuses Hotspur of recklessness in being so eager to fight an enemy of superior numbers. He says that Hotspur, quote-unquote, "with great imagination, proper to madmen, led his powers to death, and winking leaped into destruction." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 27 through 29. Hastings, however, thinks the rebels' strength of 25,000 may be enough. His reasoning is that King Henry's forces are presently divided into three contingents, quote-unquote, "one power against the French, and one against Glendower. Perforce a third must take up us." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 47 through 49. "The king is also running short of money," says Hastings. The rebels decide to move forward with their attack plans. Says Hastings, quote unquote, "We are time's subjects, and time bids be gone." Act 1, Scene 3, line 63. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, October 17, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.